History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. I have indeed, praise be to God, attained my desire in this world, which was to travel through the earth and have attained this honor, which no ordinary person has attained. This was written at the end of the life of Ibn Battuta in his travelogue, and it refers to a journey that all started in 1324, when this young North African scholar packed his bags and bade farewell to his friends and family. He set out alone for a 3,000-mile pilgrimage to Mecca, as one of his duties as a pious Muslim, a journey that normally took 16 months by land from where he was from, and was often done with fellow travelers or in a caravan. His family in Morocco expected him to return shortly after. Anytime longer, and he'd fall behind in his career, in his studies, and lose important court appointments to other legal experts who would offer their services to sovereigns or wealthy patrons. A delay of a few months was entirely reasonable for such a journey. Even 6 months was reasonable, since you couldn't count on precise schedules. What they didn't expect was that he would use his family's vast resources to continue his pilgrimage past Mecca and onto holy sites throughout the rest of the Muslim world. But most unfortunate for them was that the extent of the Islamic world had expanded considerably in the previous centuries, and it took him over 2 decades to cover it. He returned home a middle-aged man and the most traveled person in history prior to European voyages to the New World, far surpassing Marco Polo. Abu Abdullah ibn Battuta came from a prominent family of judges who studied thick tomes of Islamic law, which had expanded considerably in the several centuries since the beginning of Islam, and he wrote legally binding opinions on how to live out the law in daily life. This required the young man, fresh off his studies, to fulfill one of the 5 pillars of the religion, its most basic requirements, and complete a pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina, which was incumbent on all Muslim men who had the physical and financial means to do so. But his own pilgrimage extended far beyond Mecca because of 2 historical developments that happened. The first was the political and religious expansion of Islam. The upstart religion exploded out of the Arabian Peninsula in the 7th century, then, in 1 century, conquered the Persian Empire, engulfed Byzantine Syria, swallowed North Africa, and entered Spain in the year 711. And then it crashed against the shores of France in 732, only then stopping its expansion into Western Europe. Its western expansion ended, but it moved east into Central Asia in the early 1000s, with Muslim sovereigns conquering the Turkish tribes of Transoxania. Merchants spread the religion throughout India and Southeast Asia by the 1300s. It was a conversion of the Mongols to Islam, however, that sealed the largely sealed the religious fate of significant portions of Asia. In 1295, Mahmud Ghazan, the Buddhist ruler of the Ilkhan-Mongolian state of Iran, declared himself Muslim and compelled his subjects and other Mongolians to follow suit. The dream of Rabban Bar Salma and Marco Polo of a Christian Mongolian Khanate died, but the spread of Islam in Asia accelerated, spreading as far east as China and as south and as far south as what is today Indonesia. It was at the pinnacle of Islam's geographic expansion that Abu Abdullah ibn Battuta was born in Tangier, Morocco, in 1304. The lands in which Muslims inhabited, which stretched from the Atlantic to the Pacific, were religiously called the Ummah, the Universal Brotherhood of Islam. While political tensions existed between Islamic states and scholars and merchants, by no means were they unified, and there were already significant divisions between different groups of Islam, and borders between Sunni and Shia had been developing for centuries but had hardened significantly in the Middle Ages, travelers could move somewhat easily between these lands, particularly if they shared the Islamic faith. Legal scholars in particular traveled easily since they were in such high demand by newly Islamicized lands that needed to build a legal structure based on Sharia but lacked the expertise. Sharia law was something that handled moral matters but also financial matters. It handled issues of inheritance and divorce and tax issues. So if you were a newly Islamic republic, you needed a scholar. That meant you needed somebody who was trained in the Arabic language, who knew the centuries of Islamic legal opinion. It's sort of like having somebody who's a consultant for IBM in the 1990s or for Oracle in the 2000s. It was an expertise that was globally in high demand and could really get you a job anywhere on planet Earth. So Ibn Battuta's training made him a commodity, particularly in remote parts of the Ummah where such knowledge was rare. The second reason he was able to travel so far is that he came of age when religious obsession with pilgrimages to holy sites reached a fever pitch. Muslims had always visited the sites of Muhammad's life and his final resting place in Arabia, and such pilgrims arrived by the millions from across Eurasia and Africa. Travel was hardwired into the Islamic religion, as the Prophet himself enjoined his followers to seek knowledge, even as far as China. This led to the rise of the religious travelogue, a treatise composed for the purpose of traveling in order to search for knowledge. By the Middle Ages, however, the burial sites for the companions of Muhammad also received thousands of visitors a year, whether in Syria, in Palestine, or in Constantinople. When these sites didn't satisfy the hunger of medieval religious travelers, prophets from the Old Testament whose final resting place was unknown were given their own apocryphal birthplace or burial place. Abraham was said to have been born in the northern Syrian city of Edessa, and pilgrims flocked to his commemorative mosque. Pilgrimage destinations also filled villages in rural areas throughout the Middle East. Whenever a local saint or a leader of a religious order died, his followers constructed an ornate tomb and encouraged those in the region to visit his burial site, pray to him, and receive blessings from God. Even the tombs of Christian saints received visitors due to the practice of posthumously declaring the saint to have actually been a Muslim in his earthly life. One could easily spend a lifetime visiting the pilgrimage sites that crowded the Muslim world. This is exactly what Ibn Battuta did. He spent 3 decades traversing its extent, along with non-Muslim lands as well. So because of his chosen vocation as a scholar and travel writer, his travel from east to west, and the time period in which he lived, the Middle Ages, it's easy to compare him to Marco Polo, as he was born in the twilight years of the Italian explorer's life. The 21-year-old set off for his journey the year before Marco Polo died in 1324. Yet, even though he traveled 3 times as far as Polo, crossing Africa and Asia and China, Ibn Battuta hasn't had the same recognition. His memoirs, the Rihla, the Journey, wasn't translated into European languages until the 19th century and was unknown to Westerners except for the occasional Orientalist scholar. Its full title is A Gift to Those Who Contemplate the Wonders of Cities and the Marvels of Traveling. Despite its lofty appellation, his work lives up to the promise of wonders and marvels. When Ibn Battuta departed Tangiers in 1325, he set off with sober determination. He noted that in the Rihla that, I set out alone, finding no companion to cheer the way with friendly intercourse, and no party of travelers with whom to associate myself, but swayed by an overmastering impulse within me, and a desire long cherished in my bosom, to visit those illustrious sanctuaries. So I braced my resolution to quit all my dear ones, and forsook my home as birds forsook their nests. My parents being yet in the bonds of life, it weighed sorely upon me to part from them, and both they and I were afflicted with sorrow at this separation. So that's the why of why Ibn Battuta traveled. He had the means to do so. He had the education so he could really live off the land as long as he wanted to. He had a reason to travel, to visit different religious shrines. Now we're going to see the how of travel. How did he travel, and what did he see? What did he encounter? How did it change him? And how did he see the world changing as well? The first leg of his journey took Ibn Battuta overland across the North African coast. He typically traveled with a caravan, despite saying at the outset he was traveling by himself, and he did so to avoid attack from Bedouin tribes, a common danger to pilgrims who were going along North Africa. He stopped in the Tunisian city of Sfax, where he took a bride, the first of 8 marriages over his lifetime, that usually occurred during a lengthy stay in a travel destination. In 1326, he continued on to Alexandria and then Cairo, both part of the Mamluk Empire. Then he went through the Nile Valley to the Red Sea. Ibn Battuta then continued on a side trip to Damascus, where he celebrated Ramadan. This was a feast period for 40 days in which Muslims fast, and then at the end of it, they feast together to commemorate its end. He then stopped along the way to visit the holy cities of Hebron, Jerusalem, and Bethlehem along travel routes that the Mamluks had made, and then to Medina and ultimately Mecca. And like many Muslims, for him, he describes the experience as one of spiritual and personal growth. Afterwards, he completed the pilgrimage to Mecca and took copious notes of his experience there. In 58 pages, he described the customs and traditions of his fellow pilgrims, who came from all over the world, from Sudan to Central Asia and beyond. Once completed, though, once his pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina was complete, for an unknown reason, he didn't return to Tangiers. It could have been due to his youthful thirst for exploration and the financial means for taking such a journey. Or it could have been his desire to fulfill an Islamic injunction to seek wisdom through traveling. Whatever his reason, on November 17, 1326, he joined a caravan for Baghdad with a group of Iraqi pilgrims crossing the Arabian Desert and returning with them as they traveled home. He didn't take a direct route to Baghdad, but opted to continue with the group as far as Najjar, where he visited the mausoleum of Ali, the fourth caliph. Caliph was the spiritual and political leader of Islam, and there were only four of them after the death of Muhammad, and then the political unity of Islam as religion falls apart. He departed from them and began a six-month detour. Ibn Battuta then swung through Iran and ventured north, then followed the Tigris River to Basra, then went to Isfahan in Persia. After detouring to Shiraz, a city with well-preserved architecture because it avoided the Mongolian destruction of much of the Muslim world in the 13th century, he crossed the mountains to return to his original destination. It wasn't until 1327 that he entered Baghdad. The young scholar was impressed with the city's universities and libraries and intellectual heritage. For centuries, it was the Islamic scientific and education hub in the Middle Ages. It was the seat of the Abbasid Caliphate and the site of the world's first scientific ventures, specifically the Bayt al-Hikmah, or House of Wisdom. Here, scholars made astronomical observations, translated many books into Arabic, and even completed a map of the world as early as the 9th century. However, it had fallen into significant disrepair after the Mongols sacked the city in 1258. Parts of the city were still in ruin from the damage inflicted by the invading army. So you could see the grandeur of the city, but he could also tell that he wasn't viewing the city at its height. Since then, it had slowly begun regaining its status as a trade hub and cosmopolitan center of art and culture. Ibn Battuta stayed there for a few months, then took a tour to Azerbaijan, accompanying Abu Sa'id, the last Mongolian ruler of the unified Ilkhanate Caliphate. Eventually arriving in Mosul, he joined a feeder caravan going to Mecca. He described Baghdad and all the other cities on this itinerary with vivid detail in his Ruhla. And it's useful here to pause and take a closer look at his travelogue and consider its function, as it is the dominant source of information we have about Ibn Battuta's travels. The Ruhla is a primary work of religious devotion, and it offers a contemplative description of Islamic shrines and monuments throughout the world, but it serves many other functions. Researcher Douglas Bullis depicts it as a vast sweep of the writer's secular experiences. Ibn Battuta recounts geography, politics, natural history, local personalities, folk customs, and his own exploits in lands that lie far outside traditional Muslim pilgrimage routes. He describes lands in what is today Turkey, lands in Central Asia, East and West Africa, the Malay Peninsula, and the Maldives. As a result, the Ruhla is an important historical source for these lands. In instances in which the society in question was mostly illiterate, particularly in the many African societies he encountered, it's the only medieval primary source in existence. The Ruhla itself was produced as an oral history. When he finally came home, the Marinidi Sultan of Fez desired to have the traveler's experiences recorded. Ibn Battuta dictated his travels to the Sultan's court poet, Ibn Juzai, who edited and produced a manuscript 2 years later. The latter may have taken liberties with the former's account, which is most likely considering Ibn Battuta's recollection of the events that happened decades earlier were hazy and likely full of gaps and inconsistencies in a work that eventually totaled over 1,000 pages. Over the ensuing decades, Ibn Battuta traveled over 73,000 miles, passing through 44 present-day nations, from Egypt and Palestine to Syria, Iraq, and Persia. He also met 60 heads of state, serving as an advisor to nearly half of them as a legal scholar, and these figures pop up all over the place in his work. As his experiences grew, so did his curiosity, pushing him to venture outside of the lands of Islam. And now let's return to his travelogue and his itinerary. Ibn Battuta fell ill after reaching Mecca for his second Hajj, his second pilgrimage, forcing him to spend 3 years in the city to recover. Here, he fraternized with other Islamic scholars of the city, and because people were coming from all over the world there, it was like living in cosmopolitan New York or London, and fraternizing with these scholars gave him access to elite urban society. This was a natural network for Ibn Battuta to join. His eloquence in Arabic and his memorization of the Quran and his intimate knowledge of Islamic primary legal sources and historical sources and other works distinguish him as a man of learning. Such a social status came with many benefits during his stays in strange cities or on foreign pilgrimage routes. Bullis writes that wandering scholars were given free room and board in madrasas or in Islamic schools throughout the Muslim world. If no lodgings were available, they could sleep on the floor of a mosque. When setting out for a new city, no traveling group or caravan would turn down the request of a legal scholar to join their party. They would offer him any food or provisions necessary. With such a status, Ibn Battuta could live off the land indefinitely if he so desired. He essentially had the medieval equivalent of frequent flyer elite status. Ibn Battuta recovered in the early 1330s and traveled toward the port of Jeddah on the Red Sea, where he sailed to Yemen, visiting the townships of Zabid and Taiz, and then to the port of Aden at the southernmost tip of the Arabian Peninsula. There, he embarked on the African leg of his voyage and wrote an account that is of most interest to historians. Written accounts of the African interior south of Egypt are sparse in the medieval world, aside from that of Marco Polo, whose descriptions of Africa are arguably the most embellished of anything in his travel writings. Ibn Battuta took a ship destined for Zeila on the coast of modern-day Somalia, then Cape Guardafoy further down the seaboard, spending a week in each location. His next stop was Mogadishu, known as the greatest city in the, quote, land of the Berbers. Ibn Battuta was awestruck at the size and complexity of Cape Guardafoy in Somalia, then a home for rich merchants and the center for international trade to and from the Levant. He would later remark on the intoxicating awe he felt of this exotic city, which inspired him to explore the Swahili coast, Kilwa, and further into Arabia across the Red Sea. He described Mogadishu as an exceedingly large city that produced high-quality fabric that was exported across the continent all the way to Egypt. He met the ruler of the city, Abu Bakr ibn Sykes Umar, whom he noted spoke both Arabic and Somali, and traveled with an immense retinue of legal experts, military officials, court eunuchs, and government ministers. Ibn Battuta continued down the Swahili coast with his retinue, stopping in the island city of Kilwa in present-day Tanzania, then a center of the gold trade, and what he considered to be one of the most beautiful and well-constructed towns in the world. These journeys from Africa back through the Middle East inevitably crossed through Mecca, where he dutifully performed a pilgrimage at each pass once again. After his third pilgrimage in 1332, now he's been traveling for almost a decade, he traveled north with a caravan to southern Turkey, which he joined by working as the translator and guide to the Persian-speaking Muslim Sultan of Delhi. They traveled through Seljuk-controlled Anatolia to join a caravan route to India. And in this point, he passes through the city of Bursa, which is the capital of the new Ottoman Empire, only 30 years old at this time. At this time, it's really not much more than a small principality, but in later decades and centuries, it became one of the most powerful states in the world. And there are few early accounts of the Ottoman Empire, so his description of the city is of immense interest to Ottomanists, including yours truly. From here, Ibn Battuta continued on to the Black Sea and caught a ship heading to the port of Azov to the north. It was under the control of the Mongolian Golden Horde at this time, or Altın Ordu. Here he befriended Özbey Khan, a recent Muslim convert who, as leader of the Golden Horde, held sway over much of the Black Sea region, along with much of present-day Western Russia. Özbey invited Battuta to join his traveling court. They stopped in Bulgar, the capital of Volga Tatarstan. This city was the northernmost area he reached, and he noted the remarkably short nights. They then began their journey to Astrakhan, the capital of the Golden Horde. The Khan gave the seasoned traveler a rare gift, an unprecedented opportunity to experience something new.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Özbey had recently permitted one of his pregnant wives, Bayalun, daughter of the Byzantine Emperor Andonikos II, Palaiologos, to return to Constantinople to give birth. He assented, and it was here in 1334 that Ibn Battuta found himself outside of the Islamic world for the first time. He spent a month in Constantinople, visiting the Byzantine emperor himself and the Hagia Sophia Church, then the largest cathedral in the world. While in Asia Minor, he decided to visit the courts of other Mongolian Khanates. Ibn Battuta traveled then through Russia and the Central Asian steppe cities of Astrakhan, Bukhara, and Samarkand, eventually arriving at the court of Tarmashirin, leader of the Chagatai Khanate. Ibn Battuta passed through Afghanistan, crossed the mountain passes of the Hindu Kush, and ventured as far as Delhi. He met with the Sultan Muhammad bin Tughluq, who was impressed not only by Ibn Battuta's worldliness, but by his command of law. The ruler, who was considered the wealthiest Muslim ruler in the world at the time, and a renowned patron of religious scholars, gave the seasoned traveler a job offer. Bin Tughluq invited Ibn Battuta to become one of his judges to enforce Islamic law and prescribe legal rulings for difficult cases. His kingdom at the time was in a tumultuous state, and he needed to establish the rule of law to consolidate his political power. It was a troublesome period for Ibn Battuta, who had limited means of enforcing Sharia outside of the palace, particularly in a state in which a diversity of religions existed, and where many people there were either new converts or simply didn't understand the faith itself, so he could issue a ruling, but many might not even understand what it meant. Even his Muslim subjects outside the capital could easily ignore religious rulings, since no state authorities were present to enforce them. Furthermore, as Ibn Battuta would later comment to a biographer, the Sultan was erratic and unpredictable, making him fear that falling out of his favor could result in a swift execution order. So he was a wealthy patron, but also an unpredictable one. This led Ibn Battuta to plan a fourth pilgrimage to Mecca, perhaps done out of sincere religious conviction, but also as a handy pretext for leaving the court. His plans were waylaid, however, by the Sultan's insistence that he travel to China as ambassador to the court of the Yuan dynasty. Seems every one of our medieval travelers gets pulled to the Yuan dynasty. Makes sense, it's the wealthiest place on earth, and it exerts a magnetic pull over Eurasia, it seems like. This was a chance to see a new land, and more importantly, to escape the presence of Muhammad bin Tughluq. So even if Ibn Battuta couldn't escape by going west, he could accomplish the same thing by going east, and he accepted. Well, the journey was doomed from the beginning. While they traveled overland to an Indian port city to embark on a ship to China, Ibn Battuta's party was attacked by bandits and robbed. During the attack, he was separated from his traveling companions. It took 10 days wandering through unknown lands for him to find them again, even though he often thrived in foreign lands amidst danger. He rejoined them in Khawat in the Indian state of Gujarat. But despite this, Ibn Battuta didn't know that his life would become a series of literal and figurative shipwrecks. His spirits were lifted by a trip to a mosque on India's west coast in Kozhikode, which was visited by Vasco da Gama 2 centuries later. But his party never reached China. A hurricane ravaged the coast and sank one of the two ships, while the second ship abandoned Ibn Battuta on the shore. It was an unexpected blessing to the shipwrecked scholar, as the Sumatran king seized the crew a few months later. Ashamed of returning to the Sultan as a failure, and likely fearing for his life, Ibn Battuta remained in India under the protection of the ruler Jamal ud-Din. Delhi Sultanate was eventually overthrown, and Ibn Battuta was spared the potential consequences of his failure, but he was also a marked man, as a new claimant to the throne could target all those high officials associated with the old regime. In typical fashion, he took this as an opportunity for further exploration and sailed to the Maldives Islands. Once again, his education and status as a religious scholar opened doors with high officials. The rulers of the Buddhist island had recently converted to Islam, and like other places Ibn Battuta went to, he found himself in demand because they desired his legal expertise to consult on matters of Sharia. He fell in love with the tropical island and briefly settled here. At this time, he entered a happy marriage to a member of the royal family of Omar I, and soon married 3 other women, which is a total of 4, the maximum number allowed under Islamic law. His conservative interpretation of the Sharia made him unpopular among the ruling authorities. Ibn Battuta objected to the scantily clad Maldives women, and the seemingly irreverent and undisciplined manner in which they treated their new faith, particularly as subjects on whom the law was forced, and who paid little attention to its prohibitions on pork and alcohol or dressing immodestly. He realized that he was an impotent political figurehead with no power to enforce the law. Despite these circumscribed powers, his rise to the top of the legal system earned the jealousy of other nobles. They suspected him of plotting a coup d'etat. He realized that his time on the tropical island had come to an end. So this was the flip side of the coin of being someone who could enter any court and seem to be able to get a job, is that when he entered as an outsider, he automatically raised the suspicions of those who had been in the court for a considerable length of time and thought that he was a foreign upstart. So this was the challenge that he was always facing. Ibn Battuta continued on to Sri Lanka. He recorded his observations of the islands and the inhabitants' social practices. He traveled up to Adam's Peak, a holy site for Christians, Muslims, and Hindus. He also described the local fauna and what he called the flying leeches that inhabited the island. More danger awaited him as his boat nearly sank in a fierce squall. He put his wife safely aboard a raft, but he couldn't fit himself. He clung to the ship all night, expecting to drown at any moment. In the early morning, he was saved by a small fishing vessel. He then regrouped and formed an alliance with his brother-in-law, the Sultan Ghiyath al-Din. Ibn Battuta saw an opportunity to wrestle power away from Omar. With Ghiyath al-Din's military force under his command, Ibn Battuta could turn the fears of his former rivals on the Maldives into a reality and lead an actual military coup. However, he was repelled by his brother-in-law's treatment of non-Muslim prisoners, who, under Sharia statutes, were entitled to basic levels of humane treatment. Ibn Battuta wrote that he considered Ghiyath al-Din's behavior to be an abomination, making him question tying his fortunes to such an erratic figure. But his brother-in-law died of the plague shortly after, and Ibn Battuta abandoned his coup plans. He then set out for India's west coast, but his ship became the target of local pirates. After the attack, Ibn Battuta found himself stranded yet again and was forced to make his way through India back to the Maldives. There, he boarded a Chinese ship headed for Chittagong in modern-day Bangladesh, opposite India's east coast. Chittagong represented another frontier for Ibn Battuta. From there, he traveled through modern-day Jalalabad, where he met the celebrated Sufi Muslim Shah Jalal in 1345 after a month-long detour through the Kamaru Mountains. Ibn Battuta prayed with and befriended the famous ascetic, who lived in a cave and ate nothing but milk, butter, and yogurt. In 1345, he continued to the Samudra Pasai Sultanate in the island of Sumatra to visit the royal court. The ruler was a man after his own heart. Unlike the Sultan of Delhi, al-Malik al-Zahir Jamal ad-Din was of strict piety. He zealously enforced Islamic law, often leading armed campaigns against pagan and animist worshippers in the island's rural, forested region. He also admired Ibn Battuta's wanderlust, so much so that he commissioned a vessel for him that was bound for the Moroccans' long-awaited destination of China. The empire held a mythical status to Ibn Battuta, much as it did for Marco Polo. Both men knew that luxury goods of silk and spices and precious stones reached their homeland by passing through the hands of dozens of traders, but ultimately had their origin in China. The growth of the Abbasid Caliphate in the West and the Song Dynasty in the East only strengthened these ties. The itinerant scholar planned his next destination. Arriving in 1345 at Quanzhou in Mongolian-controlled China, Ibn Battuta saw architecture, technology, artwork, and manufactured goods that astounded him, despite having already traveled tens of thousands of miles. Again, like Marco Polo before him, he was enamored by the civilization's craftsmanship, aesthetic beauty, and cosmopolitanism. There he saw silk and porcelain of the highest quality, and exotic fruits such as watermelons and plums. He showed particular interest in Chinese cuisine, as it consisted of animals rare or forbidden in a North Africa Muslim's diet, such as frogs, pigs, and dogs. He was astounded by the universal use of paper money, a rarity in the Middle East, where no monarch or central bank maintained a large enough treasury to back up this much currency. He wrote, "If anyone goes to the bazaar with a silver dinar, no one will accept it from him unless he changes it into paper money." He noted with delight that the cost of fine porcelain was much less than in Arabian India. Ibn Battuta marveled at the talent on display, particularly of his artists. He said, "The Chinese are of all people the most skillful in depiction. I never returned to any of their cities after an earlier visit without finding my portrait and the portraits of my companions drawn on the walls and on sheets of paper exhibited in the bazaars. I was told that the Sultan had ordered this. The artists had come to the palace while we were there and observed us, drawing our portraits without our noticing." All these observations were made from a high perch in Quanzhou society, which he accessed by becoming affiliated with prominent persons in the Muslim community. Chief religious judge Sheikh al-Islam welcomed him to the community, which contained its own hospital, mosques, schools, caravan lodgings, and other fixtures of an Islamic city. The neighborhood was populated by travelers such as himself, eager to exploit the growing trade potential of the Silk Road, which in the last 100 years had seen explosive traffic due to the peace of the Mongolian Empire, the Pax Mongolica. He joined groups of merchants flowing to the capital and ultimately made his way to Beijing. Here, he presented himself as the prodigal diplomat, a long-lost member of the group that originally set out from the Delhi Sultanate years ago, even though he had long lost ties with the Delhi Sultanate. The Yuan Imperial Court received him with full honors. Entering the city, he described floating through the Grand Canal in a boat, observing the foreign wardrobe of the city's inhabitants, the women in flowered silk, and the merchants in black silk. These experiences created a conflict in his mind. As an Islamic judge who had grown up in the shadow of the global caliphate, who had fraternized with Muslim monarchs across the extent of the Ummah, from North Africa to the islands of Southeast Asia, he was raised to believe that the center of civilization lay in the kingdoms under Islamic rule. But China was an empire many times the size of the Fertile Crescent civilizations, rich with craftsmanship and invention, and the seat of Eastern philosophy and religion and Confucian moral instruction. These observations challenge Ibn Battuta's preconceived notions of the world. In 1346, after over 2 decades of travel, he decided to return to North Africa, tired of the peripatetic lifestyle, perhaps feeling isolated in a culture outside the Ummah, opulent as it might be. Ibn Battuta used his most favorite weapon in his travel arsenal to cross long distances under security, with a large caravan on a pilgrimage to Mecca, always a great pretense to get out of a situation. But despite voyaging with a well-armed retinue, the intercontinental return trip was marked by danger yet again due to the eruption of political rivalries along the Silk Road. While the party passed through the Strait of Hormuz in Iran, the last ruler of the Ilkhanid dynasty died. Violence erupted as petty factions emerged and his territories fell into chaos. Iran, which was once well-controlled and safe enough for him to cross numerous times, was the site of a fierce civil war between the Mongol rulers and their Persian subjects. Ibn Battuta arrived in Damascus in 1348 to difficult circumstances and sad tidings. A plague outbreak struck much of the Middle East and North Africa, killing as many as 1,000 in Gaza in a single day. Furthermore, he received news that his father had died 15 years earlier. His mother was still alive, but advanced in years and ailing. He completed his pilgrimage to Mecca and quickly returned home, hoping to see her before her passing. He arrived in 1349, but learned that his mother had died a mere month earlier. At this point in his journey, Ibn Battuta arrived home to little fanfare. He doesn't record his emotions at witnessing familiar sights once again after an absence of 25 years, seeing cousins that had grown from children to men, uncles that had grown from men to the hobbling elderly. However, this should be understood less as a mark of his soullessness and more as evidence of the literary form of the time. Medieval narrative chronicles were more concerned with places and events and notables and not the personal musings of the author. The concept of the narrated self is omnipresent today, but was rare before the Enlightenment, although it did exist. But what does receive significant attention by scholars in his travel writings upon his return to Morocco is his meeting with Sultan Abu Inan, the Marinid Sultan. Since he was the patron of the Rifla, it's little surprising that Ibn Battuta skips over any mention of reuniting with his family and jumps into pages of praise for the wealthy ruler. I mean, you have to praise your patron, or you just don't know how to receive a patronage. He was back in his native North Africa, but Ibn Battuta's journeys didn't come to an end. In 1350, the 46-year-old traveler... traveled through Gibraltar and into Muslim-controlled Spain to the Andalusian cities of Valencia and Granada. There, Alfonso XI of Castile and Leon threatened to attack Gibraltar, and he joined a group that desired to defend their religious brethren across the strait. This invasion never materialized, as Alfonso died of the plague shortly afterwards. At this point, the Muslim presence in Andalusia is waning, and it would collapse a century earlier, but there's really only holdings along the Mediterranean coast of Spain at this time. Ibn Battuta's final trip was across the Sahara to the Muslim kingdom of Mali. There lived Musa I, who was famed for his unparalleled wealth, and some consider him to be the wealthiest person who ever lived. He was wealthier than any of the dozens of monarchs that Ibn Battuta had met over the decades. When Musa I, who was so wealthy because he controlled West Africa's salt and gold trade, made his pilgrimage from his kingdom to Mecca in 1324, the procession reportedly included 60,000 men, 12,000 slaves, and this might be embellished, but it's recorded that each held a 4-pound gold bar, and heralds adorned with silk-clutching gold staves, and there were horses organized with handled bags. There were 80 camels, each carrying between 50 and 300 pounds of gold, which was distributed to the poor along the journey. If sources are to be believed, he funded the construction of a new mosque each Friday. The king's wealth was so enormous that his inflation-adjusted fortune may have equaled up to $400 billion, richer than Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk or anyone today. His infusion of gold into the economies of Egypt and Mecca and Medina are believed to have crashed the local economies as the metal was enormously devalued. Although Musa died before Ibn Battuta could meet him, explorers intrepid as himself likely were curious about visiting such an illustrious figure's empire, even if it required him to go to Mali, which meant crossing the Sahara. Furthermore, the expanding kingdom of Mali would likely be in the need of the legal knowledge possessed by an educated man such as himself, and he couldn't resist his old tendencies to enter a new foreign court and present his services and get himself a new position. As Ibn Battuta had few prospects for high placement in Morocco's legal system, he believed that the court of Mali was capable of paying him a salary he deserved. In 1352, he arrived in Sijilmassa, along the southern tip of Morocco, purchased a number of camels, and remained there for 4 months, preparing for the Sahara crossing, which, of course, you really need to stock up on provisions, have a good local guide, and everything you needed to do so successfully. Later that year, he began the journey in the sweltering heat with his caravan, experiencing temperatures unlike anything in any of the deserts he had crossed. The party continued, eventually reaching the oasis of Tasarala for a brief respite. Here came the longest and hardest section of the crossing of the Sahara. He sent ahead a scout to the oasis of Ouallata, the next stop of their journey, to procure camels and water and meet them halfway in the desert. After stocking up on these provisions and drinking much-needed water, the caravan reached the end of the desert and arrived triumphantly in the capital of the Mali Empire. He met King Suleiman, whom Ibn Battuta recounted with utter disappointment as a miserly king, and a big gift is not to be expected from him. He then left Suleiman's court with a merchant and journeyed to Timbuktu, which flourished later in the 14th century for its trade in salt, gold, ivory, and slaves. During Ibn Battuta's 1353 visit, it was still relatively unimportant and held little interest, so he quickly moved on to Gao. He continued to travel the region along the Niger River until the Sultan of Morocco sent him a message commanding him to return home. He returned with a caravan transporting 600 black female slaves. In Morocco, Ibn Battuta befriended the chronicler Ibn Juzay, who was fascinated by the stories of his travels. Sultan Abu Inan considered his stories worth recounting, and in 1354 commissioned Ibn Juzay to compose an account. Although the purpose of the Rihla was to serve as a repository for his experiences during the trip to Mecca, and indirectly, but more importantly, as praise to his patron, the Sultan of Morocco, the work is remembered as the greatest of medieval travel logs, or one of the greatest, competing with and, in some would argue, surpassing the account of Marco Polo. Furthermore, it was transmitted through the skilled pen of Ibn Juzay and contains all the literary flourishes expected by a paid court chronicler of a powerful monarch. We don't know much about Ibn Battuta's life after the Rihla. Upon completion of the Rihla in 1355, Ibn Battuta was appointed to a judgeship in Morocco. Here, he spent the remainder of his life. He died in 1369. Ibn Battuta wasn't famous in his life or immediately after his death. Bullis notes that contemporary Islamic scholars flatly disbelieved his stories of distant lands, considering them to be the imaginative products of a mid-level judge who could never hold down a job for long. Ibn Khaldun, the 14th century Tunisian historiographer and historian, said that he reported things that his listeners considered strange. Abu al-Bakrat al-Balafiki of Granada called him purely and simply a liar. He remained little known outside of North Africa and was soon forgotten. But his star has risen in the modern era. French scholars discovered manuscripts of his book in the 1830s during the occupation of Algeria. They were sent to France, and Orientalist researchers Charles de Frémery and Beniamino Sanguinetti began translating them from Arabic. They published a four-volume set of the Rihla in 1853. The great 20th century Middle East historian H.R.R. Gibb published an unabridged English translation in 1958. Since then, Ibn Battuta has become a widely known and respected historical figure, joining the pantheon of great medieval travelers. His legacy is one of rich exploration and the development of a cosmopolitan perspective on the Muslim world during the height of its influence and at the maximum reach of its extent. Yet his journeys took him far outside the traditional holy cities of Islam and challenge the ideals that he sought to nurture throughout his life. As an explorer, he still inspires those to seek out the uncomfortable or foreign, and as a chronicler, he inspires historians with his detailed account of a distant past that he helped to illuminate. All right, well, that's all for this episode. In the next episode, as part of the series on travelers and explorers, we're going to look at the last person in the late medieval and entering into the early modern period. And in all of our travelers so far, they have been interested in China, had some connection to it, because as I said, it exerts a gravitational pull on the Silk Road. So now we're going to look and explore from China himself. He is an admiral, Zhang He, probably one of the most famous admirals in history. We're going to look at his massive fleet he led all throughout the Indian Ocean from Indonesia to the coast of Africa. See you then.
All right, listeners, well, that is all that I have for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, The McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraza. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a 3-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.